This is Tim McHenry, producer of the Rubin Museum of Art, and you are listening to the Red Book Dialogues on WNYC's Talk to Me series.
Please welcome Harry Fogarty and the great Alice Walker to the stage. Thank you.
What a wonderful honor we all have tonight to be in conversation through Carl Jung with one another, with Alice, and in many ways, I want to let our conversation simply unfold. So I plan to say only the tiniest bit by way of introduction. Jung felt ghosted by the past. We all are ghosted by our own past, parts of us that feel dead, the voices of the dead, issues that are deadening. In some way, the Red Book is a manifestation of his exchange with the dead. Recently, I had the chance of watching an interview with Alice at Emory when a collection of her papers was installed there. And if I recollect correctly, at one point you said, well, these are looking at old clothes. We are not here to look at the old clothes. As it is said in the biblical narrative, when the apostle to the apostles, Mary Magdalene, went to the tomb, she was asked, why are you looking for the living among the dead? So my hope is as we engage old questions, old feelings, deep questions, we might find the living, what wants to be lived. So let me present you with this image. And our hope is as Alice looks at the image and engages it, she will begin to converse with us as to what it inspires in her.
I see our deep need for guidance from the great feminine who is in this painting, accompanied by the moon, a moon that in my own work, when it is in this phase, is considered to be a smiling moon. And in fact, one of my novels is called By the Light of My Father's Smile. And it is exactly this smile that I am exploring to connect men to the moon in the same way that women always feel connected to the moon by our menstrual cycles. I see people actually below very, some of them a little concerned and maybe confused, but many very willing and happy to see a new acknowledgement of something so primal as our connection to the moon and beyond the moon, the rest of the cosmos. That's the beginning.
That's a wonderful beginning. That's great. I wonder if I can help a little bit with disclosing the translation of the inscriptions. On the left of the picture, in Arabic, is the Arabic word for daughters. Going around the frieze on the three sides is a quotation from Paul's letter to the Corinthians. He selects just a little bit of this quotation. God's wisdom, secret and hidden, which God declared before the ages for our glory. The Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. Mm. So when you consider this and daughters and God's wisdom, I wonder what it evokes for you.
For me, God's wisdom is always not even hidden, but apparent in nature. So I feel when I look at this, with the light shimmering above this figure, and this figure, which I think of as feminine, I feel that connection between the what we think of as the natural world and the human world, the feminine, both of them. And I feel that the structure here is the masculine in its best use, which is protection of the feminine and of the people.
In the series of paintings that Jung did, which he did after he had finished writing the Red Book. You could say it was a continuing imagination. At various points, he had emblematic figures of the dome, the church. And if you look at the picture, you can tell it is set within a church-like, dome-like structure. He refers to this as the return of wisdom, the return of the feminine to religion. When you think about religion and men's religion, I wonder, Alice, what kinds of things that opens up for you?
The damage that has been done by it. And the hope that we can, by reinstating the feminine, bring balance to some of the ideology that has been so harmful, especially to the feminine. I have a very strong hope that the suffering that religion has often caused planetarily will be seen and recognized, acknowledged, and people will then, men included, especially men maybe, but that they will be moved to change the way that they have used religion as something that dominates people rather than something that lifts people. I am such an animist and such a pagan and such a believer in what is natural and feel completely surrounded by God and with God and in God and God myself, that I have never felt a real need for religion beyond the wonderful stories that are teaching stories and that help the soul. But I've never felt the need to have a religion that is dominating and domineering and is interested in especially trampling the feminine. This has been a great suffering for the planet. So I am truly desiring that as we face this rather scary future that Al Gore describes as a possibility of the Earth being frozen under a mile-high covering of ice, as we face this, I hope that each person who has ever felt that religion has not been helpful will interrogate that religion. And if that religion is not something that is healthy for beings, not just humans, then I think that there is a responsibility to abandon it and to search for whatever is sustaining of our possibility of survival and thriving. We have drifted far too long in this almost like a dream, but a nightmare dream, that somehow we are being saved by something beyond ourselves. We're not. It's impossible. We have to do the whole work. That is why I love Jung. I'm here just really because I love him, and I think that he is one of these forces, you know, to awaken us to ourselves, our inner deep selves, to take on the challenge of transformation of the planet quickly.
In your own travels, I know from some of the things I've been privileged to read, you had very profound transformative experiences in Africa. Mm-hmm. This particular picture was painted after Jung had made his first journey to Africa, Northern Africa, and hence perhaps the Arabic influence and perhaps mm-hmm. some Islamic influence in this image of the return of a lost feminine, mm-hmm. the feminine that was in exile, to the altar. The feminine here has become the altar in the church. It was painted before his second trip to Africa, but very much inspired by the types of things that stirred in him in a profoundly different way. And so I wonder, when you think of not just our religions, but African cultures and the way, oddly enough, the culture itself, not necessarily just the fathers, but the mothers, end up doing something quite harmful to the daughters. Mm-hmm. What this would stir for you.
Well, you brought me actually to one of the points of my life in encountering Jung. I was trying to write about just this abandonment of the feminine, the degradation of the feminine in some African cultures through the practice of female genital mutilation. And when I attempt to encounter deeply these harmful things to humanity, I sometimes become sick myself. And I have worked to understand that, and I think it's true that healers often do take on the sickness because they have to get through it for everyone. So I was needing guidance and assistance to deal with the fact that in so many African cultures and Arabic ones as well, but I was working in Africa, there was this practice where the feminine at a very early age was just held down and mutilated. It took me 20 years to actually bring, well, I had to learn a lot of things, but it took me 20 years to bring my full courage to the subject. It was so appalling. And it was affecting over 100 million women, and it still is, actually, although we're making a dent. So I literally called on Jung to help me. I started studying Jung and loved so many of his ideas and thought he was really onto something by going so deeply into the soul, the psyche, just what it is in people that is already there that makes them behave in certain ways. So I did a number of things, including going to his retreat in Bolingen, because I felt like I had to write a novel called Possessing the Secret of Joy about the practice, but about the impact, the psychological impact on people, on women and girls. And I went there to his place by Lake Zurich and just touched and stood and looked and received what I felt to be assurance that you are about to take on this subject, which is taboo in most African cultures. It was taboo and very dangerous, but you will not be alone. And that is all one can ask, I think, whether you're asking it of living people or whether you're asking it of people who are no longer alive in the body, just to know that you're no longer alone as you travel these paths that are sometimes so treacherous. So it's a beginning. I mean, I thank Jung in the book. I actually turned him into a character in the novel, and he helps in the healing of a woman who was mutilated. And it was a beginning. Africa is vast, and the suffering is horrific for so many people, different kinds of suffering. But we were able to start the abolitionist movement in Africa against female genital mutilation, and I have gone back to be with some of the people who are the abolitionists. And what can you do, really, with something so enormous and that causes so much damage? It is through this practice that AIDS, for instance, just went wild across the continent and destroyed so much that was viable. We have to just accept, I think, as I do, that we just begin. We just start. Somewhere we start. And if we're very fortunate, very, very fortunate, we start with someone who seems so unlikely as a companion on this trip, but who is, who is there going deeply into what it is to be human and what are the things that we do to each other that tell us our illness and demonstrate our fear and our reluctance to change and grow.
the way Alice puts it, "We just start," takes my own breath away, because these are such tremendously daunting tasks. Jung was confronting utter loss within himself, and in listening to the dead, as it were, wrestling with so much in his own life or the European culture, it was dimly aware of its own losses or the losses of colonization. So I find it interesting when you look at the picture, some of the people are smiling. Some have their hands out, welcoming. There are a few children, but they're, as with typically the case, they're in the back, so they don't get a good view. This little girl, and there's a girl there, and a boy, they're all right down there. But a number of the other faces, let us say, are not very friendly. Mm-hmm. The priest has his hand up. Some have their hands up to welcome, but many do not. And so I wonder, when you contemplate either your own journey, what brought you to Jung, or that phenomenon of raising up what is vital within oneself or culturally, and it is not welcome, what has sustained you? What you touched the stones in Balingen, but I imagine that something has sustained you in your own connection with deep feminine.
Well, when you're talking, Harry, what comes to mind is, I think, a song from when I was really very young, but in there's a line that says, "I will put on the full armor. I will completely dress for battle." And it's a spiritual situation. It's not like you're putting on, mail or metal or anything like that. But it's what I think we are called to do when we confront the things that are happening today on the planet, that you have to develop a sense of warriorship, and to get up every day and put on the full armor that takes you into the battle of basically for our future, for the children of the planet. And it is daunting. It is really daunting. I've just this may be an aside, but I felt like I was too old to adopt an orphan, and I'm very distractible, so I'm probably not the best person to ever try to raise anybody. But I realized that I could actually adopt an orphanage. And so I adopted an orphanage. And that is in response to the reality that there are 12 million, at least, 12 million homeless children, parentless children in Africa. And I cannot bear it. I cannot bear this. The only way I can bear it is to, as in bearing the fact that so many millions of children are mutilated, is to just think about one child at a time, just one. And often when I'm in Africa, children are attracted to me. I think, I don't know why that is, actually, because I've always been a little shy of them, but they are attracted to me, and they will come and just hold on to me. And often I face a moment of great pain and crisis, because I know that the very child that's holding my hand is one that I can do nothing to save or to protect. But still, I feel like I put on my armor and I go out and I try to make that one child feel safe. And that's one of the reasons I so love this book. I haven't seen it all. I just was out there looking at the drawings. But the work of every single person is to do this, is to go deeply enough inside yourself and clear out your own demons so that you don't project them. I mean, that is just, psychology 101.
We seem to be pretty slow on the uptake, though.
We are. Exactly. But it's so crucial. And I got here roundabout the way, and because I just believe so deeply in that, that if you take care of your own demons, that's saving the world, because they don't then run all over the place and destroy other people.
One of Jung's early images as he began his own explorations, which definitely had to do with his own demons and how his own demons linked to collective demons, how we all share similar dilemmas, was of a guiding figure. And in this instance, the guiding figure was a wisdom figure. So I want to point to something that is barely discernible in the picture, and in perhaps a slightly more personal way, Alice, recollect an event from your own life. Mm-hmm. In the corners up here, mm-hmm. where it's very hard to read, there is a quote on each side. And the quote is from Revelation chapter 22. The Spirit and the Bride say, "Come." And let everyone who hears say, "Come." And let everyone who is thirsty come. Let anyone who wishes to take the water of life as a gift. In Jung's early visions, his guide was blind. Salome was blind. He suffers, if you will, from a type of masculine blindness to the inner feminine, the inner soul. His soul could only see a bit. Yet this is the invitation. Let anyone who is thirsty, any of us in our struggles, come. Now, I know in your own personal biography, there was a tremendous event in your growing up. And I wonder, what did you do to wrestle with that demon?
Do you mean my fear of blindness?
The way in which you had to bear your brother's actions.
Oh, yes. Well, I was, when I was 8 years old, I was shot with a pellet gun by one of my brothers in my eye, one of my eyes, and I lost the vision of that eye. And also, it wasn't repaired for 6 years. So for 6 years, I descended. I went into a descent because I don't know, I'm sure many people here have had a similar experience of something really traumatic happening to you, and yet because of circumstances, you have to carry on as if nothing has happened. So to my parents, I didn't change at all, which is always amazing to me. They say to me, "Well, but you were the same sweet, sunny person." But the same sweet, sunny person, from the way that I saw it, had completely disappeared. That was a fake. And the real person had gone deep underground and wrestled with many, many, many demons before coming out again 6 years later. And I learned a lot while I was down there. Something, you know, there's another expression about the fire entering the soul, you know. I think that's when you realize that nobody on the planet really sees you the way that you see yourself. And they don't know what is happening in the descent that you are, you know, reeling and tumbling through. Nor do they have your awareness that you may never come up again. You know, this is what I thought as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old. I thought it was entirely possible that I would not resurface. Meanwhile, I was so well behaved and so well trained not to be a burden that they couldn't tell that I was actually feeling the wound that everybody could see, but that I rose, in their opinion, rose above.
I think that's an experience that perhaps we each have some taste of ourselves. For Jung, many of his most profound early experiences were when he was slightly younger than that. Mm-hmm. He felt as if something addressed him, overwhelmed him, demanded something from him. But as with you, he was a very bright boy, very competent, mm-hmm. and nobody could notice.
Yeah.
He was carried by certain things that he did. What carried you then? What carries you now? In this image, it's the return of the feminine that Jung is saying might carry him or might carry us as picking up what is lost. But when you think of what's been missing, what has carried you? What carries you now? What carried you in that dark night, literally?
It's the very same thing, nature. Without nature, I couldn't imagine surviving. I hate to say neglected, because my parents had 8 children. They were working night and day. They did the very best that they could do. And, you know, if I had 8 children, I don't know what I'd do. I probably wouldn't be here. But anyway, I was very careful. But, you know, I was babysat by nature. I took myself. Fortunately, I didn't live in the city. I lived in the country. And the countryside was exquisitely beautiful. And I took myself there, buried myself deeply, talked to more trees than you could imagine, and realized my absolute oneness with all of that. And I had that, you know. And it's interesting because it was a refuge that nobody around me recognized. You know, they were busy having to do things like cut trees down and, you know, make the soil give us sustenance, you know, planting crops and doing all those things. I was interested in what was not being abused, what was free and what was green and what was growing. And that became my other mother, my other parent. And so it's very similar, really. You know, this is the same feminine. This one is a human form, but it could as well be a tree. It could as well be fish swimming in a stream. It could as well be, you know, the night sky, the sun, as well as the moon. And, you know, really, I do worry about us as humans as we destroy so much of nature, because without it, I don't see us evolving very much.
This same fear, as Tim observed, was part of what ghosted Jung as World War I was breaking out. The sea of red blood, terrible dreads. So I wonder if we could look at this just slightly more fully in another way. This is the return of the feminine, and still, one might suggest with Arabic or African lineages, a highly abused feminine. You were sustained by the mother, nature, so to speak. Why are we so frightened of the mother? How is it that the feminine went into exile? Why do you imagine the daughters, as in some cultures, are small joys? What in yourself, with your own struggles, within your own very loving family, parents who rebuilt a school when it was burnt, what is it that is so frightening, do you imagine, that has us doing these incredibly harmful things to ourselves, our inner psyches, to others, to the feminine? What are we so afraid of that you were open to? Something in you was profoundly open to what many seem to just run from.
I think that suffering takes us down to nature, and that nature is always waiting to be seen and to be recognized. And in some cultures, of course, like Native American cultures, not all of them, but some of them, on this continent, people were not afraid of nature. They thought it was just awesome, which is actually my favorite word for it. I think that there are different reasons in different parts of the world. I think that people who really suffered those long, long, long centuries of the Ice Age really became disconnected from the natural world, except as something to subdue and to get food from. I think the coldness, you know, the long period of just no sun. And I think that in places on the planet where this was not happening, where people, you know, still were getting some sun, having a few spices, it was quite different. And in some of those cultures, I think that women did, you know, there was the matriarchal cultures often. However, I think that there is or was, there developed, for whatever reason, a fear of the feminine, partly because it is so powerful that the feminine, a free feminine is incredibly powerful because she has the power of life and death. And that means that she doesn't have to have 8 children. She can have as many or none. And I think for men who grew up to believe that they need soldiers, warriors, you know, employees, they developed this need to control that source. And that's part of the problem. And that's why often you know, when a woman is being free, there is an enormous amount of fear. I mean, even here, there's so much fear. But because women can produce the human race, you know, over and over, or not, it is high time and beyond the right time to have feminine leadership to save the planet, because otherwise we won't make it. And we all know this, really. We know that unless women are free to determine the number of people on the planet, you know, how can we make it? We're overpopulated, and it's not of our doing. We're forced to overpopulate the planet in a completely unsustainable way. We cannot sustain all these people that women are being forced to produce. And I'm, you know, so sorry when I can't be joyful when people tell me, oh yeah, well I just took my fertility drug and I'm gonna have 6 kids. Who is gonna take care of those 6 children in a planet that's shrinking the way this one is? And the natural wisdom of the feminine, like this feminine here who's returning, her return won't mean anything unless she's totally free to make decisions about her life and about the population of the world.
For Jung, the return of the feminine is really emblematic of the recovery of what we have lost. We all, to some degree, are doomed developmentally, culturally, to lose parts of ourselves. As in your example of your own childhood, the family, the group, wants us to be a certain way, and that way more or less works. He was plunged into having to recover what was lost in himself and emblematically for all of us. I think it's true that it is frightening because usually what is lost is experienced as so much greater than we are. It's like an enormous torrential archetypal force. I'm reminded in your story, Recovering the Secret of Joy, that the termite hill was threatening and it would have to be chopped down. So in a way, the picture invites us to think about what we experience as so threatening that we've had to chop it out of our awareness, keep it away, not let it in. And again, there's another tiny inscription right up at the top, right there, from an old Latin hymn. And it's interesting, Jung's reflections, if you will, take him through the Middle Ages. You could say that's where his dead lived. Mm-hmm. The parts of his culture that were dead lived. And he needed to address them. And this is a hymn to Hail, Virgin of Virgins. Hail, light of lights. Hail the star that is the mediator between the criminal and God. So in some sense, it's our own experience of criminality that needs to be redeemed and engaged and encountered. But when again you revisit this, perhaps within the sense of something allowing you to make that journey, to enter deeply as a young woman, as a girl, in your own education, with all the profound events you've participated in, would you say that for you, for Jung, it's the recovery of the lost feminine? It's returning, if you will, the anima to the churches, the dead churches, the religions that have sent what's vital into exile. Mm-hmm. As a woman, was this what was lost for you? You've witnessed profoundly. Here is why I'm asking. Jung has tremendous things that we can touch, like the stone at Bollingen that Alice touched. But this is a man's imagining, a man's imaginings of the dilemmas and dramas, enormously profound. For you, would you say it was the feminine or nature that was lost when you were in those darker places? If something was returning to your own inner temple, what would it be?
Wonder.
Wonder.
Mm. And I can barely breathe without wonder. I miss it so. It's my natural state of being. And to lose that because I'm wrestling with a huge whatever it is so terrible. But what I learned in my descent as a child, this is the main thing I think that I got from that. I learned that you can descend very far and you can come out again. And I learned that with the help of nature, you know, just being there waving, you know, like branches, leaves, fish, birds, they stitched me to reality. So that I wasn't ever just left completely down there, you know. But just to learn that you can go very far, you can fall to the bottom and through the bottom and come up again and rise, you know, has really sustained me in every single situation, frightening situation in my life. You know, I went to Mississippi by myself because, you know, nobody else wanted to go.
That's it.
But for me, it was just that feeling that I would, you know, possibly really go down and that I would be sustained by the ground. I would fall on the ground and I would be held there, and that was fine. And that having gone through this descent and this rising when I was relatively small, I knew that it was possible to hit the ground and to bounce in a way, you know, but not to fear the fall. Whatever was gonna happen there, not to fear it. And this has really sustained me. I feel, you know, once I got the understanding that there really is no death, you know, how could there be? I mean, it just isn't possible. Because everything transforms into something else. And even though people try to hide themselves from Earth by getting metal caskets, that's always so humorous. But once you understand there is no death, and also that if you fall, I love Earth so much, I love nature so much, that I used to have this wish that, okay, I fall, but just let me fall on some grass. Let me fall near a tree that I can feel. Let me fall by a river or something. You know, this is the, you know. But then I really got it that you could fall you know, in a concrete cell, and it's still nature because nature made the concrete. So really there's nowhere that you can fall that's not sacred. And that is very helpful.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.